the Viking Age was from roughly 700 CE to about 1100 CE. And not everybody in Scandinavia at the time was a Viking. Viking was a job, not a race of people. And to go a Viking for a lot of them was just like a summer gig, right? Like they would just go off raid and then come home and farm, and that would be their whole thing. But they'd come back with like shiny things that they stole from monks, and sometimes monks that they stole. The things that we know today about the Viking Age come from a variety of places. So one of the places is archaeology, things that we dig up out of the ground. But that is problematic because the dead don't bury themselves, basically, right? So like whatever we can dig up, it only tells us part of the story. And there's a joke in archaeology like, oh, we don't know what this is. It was used for ritual purposes. So like, that's the whole thing. The second way we know anything about this time period is from writings from other people in this time period, because people in the Viking Age, Scandinavia, and the places where the Vikings went, they didn't write their own histories. Like they didn't sit down and be like, this is all about our culture, right? They would raise commemorative runestones, they would make art and crafts, but they didn't like sit down and write out their stories.
What is up, everybody? You're listening to episode 64 of SFF Addicts. I'm your host, Adrian M. Gibson, and welcome to your weekly dive into the world of science fiction, fantasy, and writing craft. Joining me, as always, is my co-host, the Chewie to my Han Solo, the Joker to my Commander Shepard, MJ Kuhn. How's it going, MJ?
I am great. How are you?
I'm doing very well. And last episode, we pimped Thick as Thieves and The Weaver and the Witch Queen, which are Genevieve and MJ's new books. But go support MJ, pick up Among Thieves, then read the sequel, then be satisfied that it's a duology, and don't ask for more. Oh, beautiful.
Or do so she can write more in that world.
See, exactly. There you go.
Hi, I'm Genevieve, by the way. Hi. This is a new episode. This is a new episode, new introduction.
You're too fucking early.
Sorry.
She's too excited.
That's all good. As well, a quick note for everyone out there listening or watching, the official SFF Addicts Patreon and merch store are live, so check the links in the description to support what we do here. Also, don't forget to rate and read the podcast on your favorite podcast app and subscribe to the FanFatic YouTube channel, where this and every other episode of the show is available in full video. And as you already know, joining us once again is Genevieve Gornacek and her cat Banks, author of The Witch's Heart and The Weaver and the Witch Queen. Banks
is the cat.
No, is not the author. Genevieve is the author. Welcome back, Jen. How's
it going? My co-author.
My
he's co-author. So mad. He's,
my
he's so mad he's not credited.
My ghostwriter. Yeah. How's it going?
I'm good. How are you?
Doing really well. All right.
This episode is off to a smashing start. The keyboard is still connected.
He's trying to write his next novel, Genevieve.
Yeah,
listen. Off. Okay. Because then if he steps on it, it's going to ruin our whole thing. So sorry. I'm so sorry. See, I've gotten comfortable.
I love it.
A heads up, this is part two of our two-part chat with Genevieve. So I recommend checking out part one for our book launch party that was celebrating the releases of MJ and Genevieve's new books. Today, though, we're heading north and calling upon the power of the old gods as we delve into a mini masterclass on Norse mythology and culture. Before we dig deeper, I think it's best if we cover some of the basics. So, Genevieve, can you give us a general overview of Norse culture as it stands from your perspective?
Oh my gosh. Listen, I'm like trying to write blogs about this now, and they're like, it's max 1,000 words. I'm like, what if 3,000 words? And they're like, no. So I'm sorry. It's really hard for me to just be like, here's the Cliff's Notes version. Okay. So, oh my gosh, I don't even know where to start. Now I'm thinking back to like a PowerPoint that I did when my Viking Age Living History group just did a library presentation, and so like I had to like be like, okay, I sit down, I'm like, who is Thor? What is a Viking? So the Viking Age was from roughly 700 CE to about 1100 CE, and not everybody in Scandinavia at the time was a Viking. Viking was a job, not a race of people. And to go a Viking for a lot of them was just like a summer gig, right? Like they would just go off, raid, and then come home and farm. And that would be their whole thing. But they'd come back with like shiny things that they stole from monks. And sometimes monks that they stole from
other
and work on the farm.
Right. And like, if you've ever seen History Channel's Vikings or like Netflix's Norsemen or even The Northmen, which came out last year, they thankfully like do not gloss over the fact that like slavery was a thing in this time period, unfortunately. And I think that's something that a lot of people like don't think of when they think of Vikings, because that's like, that's icky, right? Yeah. Like, ew. So sorry, before I go like down that road, let me try to recalibrate. Okay. So the things that we know today about the Viking Age come from a variety of places. So one of the places is archaeology, things that we dig up out of the ground. But that is problematic because the dead don't bury themselves, basically, right? So like whatever we can dig up, it only tells us part of the story. And there's a joke in archaeology like, oh, we don't know what this is. It was used for ritual purposes. So like, that's the whole thing. The second way we know anything about this time period is from writings from other people in this time period, because people in the Viking Age, Scandinavia, and the places where the Vikings went, they didn't write their own histories. Like they didn't sit down and be like, this is all about our culture, right? They would raise commemorative runestones, they would make art and crafts, but they didn't like sit down and write out
oral storytelling was a bigger part of their culture.
Exactly. Yeah. Yes. So oral storytelling in this culture was huge. Poetry, especially. Poetry was a form of currency, basically, because, you know, you could pass it around, everybody remembers it. A bad poem could make or break a reputation, like a good poem and a bad poem. So like the sagas are full of like insulting poetry too, as well,
good ancient poetry. Rap battles or slam poetry.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And so like mentioning the sagas, the third way, I'm so sorry. So the reason that the writings that come from elsewhere about the Vikings while the Vikings were around are problematic is because they were usually written by the people that the Vikings were raiding. Mm-hmm. So like we didn't, like that, yeah. Not very favorable. Like these guys came and just trashed our monastery and stole all of our book covers, but not our books because they don't know how to read.
Tattooed beard motherfuckers.
Literally. And yes. So, and then the third way we know anything is through the writings of the descendants of the people who lived in the Viking Age who had since converted to Christianity. So they're looking back a couple hundred years at their own ancestors. So they've already got that lens that they're looking back, right? And they didn't have Google. They couldn't Google like when people were born or like what really happened. So what you have is a lot of conflicting sources. And we don't know what is like true and what's not. So it's very like, it's fun. It's like a big puzzle. Yes. And of those writings from several centuries later, we have the Norse myths, which we get from the Prose Edda and the Poetic Edda, which were written by 13th century Icelander Snorri Sturluson. Only the Prose Edda. Oh my God. Why did I flub that? Just the Prose Edda was written by Snorri. The Poetic Edda is a
compilation. You, cuz.
Snorri. I love the name Snorri. Sorry. Aside. Know, sounds right? Like a Pokemon, but yeah.
Yeah. Right. No, for real though. And the Poetic Edda is a compilation of anonymous poems that have just been collected and called the Poetic Edda. Most of them survive in a teeny tiny little book called the Codex Regius, which is in Iceland. He wrote in Iceland, he traveled, but Snorri did. Sorry. Oh my God. Genevieve, calm down. Speak the words you
don't
mean.
Calm down. You're so excited about this and I love it.
I get really excited.
I love it.
Stuff. So, and then, so the sagas, when I say the sagas, I mean the Icelandic family sagas, because the Icelandic sagas themselves, like span from like king sagas to like ancient legendary sagas, which is where you see all the shield maidens. And then you have like the family sagas, which are the more realistic ones that are supposed to take place during the Viking Age, when the national kind of myth that the sagas paint is that once Harald Fairhair took control in Norway in the late 9th century, there was an exodus of people who like did not want to live under one king, and they either like decided to leave or they pissed him off and they had to leave. So that's how we got Iceland, according to the sagas. And so the Icelanders were kind of like later known as like kind of the historiographers of the North. Like they wrote everything down. And that is how a lot of the stuff survives for us.
From the histories to the mythologies of, yes, of the gods and deities that we now know.
Yes, exactly. But again, those sources are problematic because they come from hundreds of years later. So when you're trying to reconstruct what the Viking Age might have looked like, you kind of have to use all of these sources. Archaeology, contemporary literary sources not from the Vikings, and later literary sources from Vikings' descendants. Like, so it gets complicated really fast. And there's a lot of like misinformation. People like will put something in a meme and then other people latch onto it, like spread it like wildfire. And it's like, this is not corroborated in any source. But then you got people going, but who cares? Cause the sources are unreliable anyway. So it's like, then what do we know?
Yeah. Right.
At that point, it's like, what is the point of any of this?
Yeah. Exactly.
If we can't, you can
go down that rabbit hole. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh, shit.
I'm like, why couldn't I have become obsessed with like the 1700s where people wrote down everything, or like 1800s. You know, why can't I become obsessed with like modern times? Why did I have to pick this time period? This time period picked me. I had no choice.
I was going to ask you, is there something that drew you to it? Like, what in particular is it about the Norse culture, mythology, all of that, this period in history that is especially fascinating for you?
So it all started when I studied abroad in Sweden when I was in college on scholarship. This was during the recession. So like I had to have a scholarship if I wanted to go abroad. So I did. And while I was there, I was like, oh my God, like a runestone. That's cool. I don't know anything about this. And then I decided to do a Scandinavian studies minor because obviously I just spent 4 months living in Scandinavia. And one of the only classes available the semester when I returned to the Ohio State University was Old Norse language. And I emailed the professor. I'm like, hey, this is like a high level class. Are there any prereqs? And she's like, no, you're good. Sign up. And I did.
You're like, okay, no pressure.
When I tell you that, like, I left that classroom for the first time, like just knowing that like my life was going to be different now, like that's literally how I felt. So the language and the academic study of this time period is kind of what first like drew me in. Because there's, you get the feeling reading like the myths and sagas that there's so much more that we're not being told. There's so much more about all of this to explore. And so I just started digging. And then I joined a Viking Age Living History crew when I couldn't afford grad school for Viking studies. So here I am.
I love it. I love it. Now, do you have any favorite like historical figures I'm assuming Gunnhild probably, yes, is up there. Yeah. Yes. Or what about like, yes, gods and goddesses within the Norse pantheon? Like who are your faves?
that's really hard. I don't think that I could answer that. Except to say that I love Skadi.
Yeah.
I can just talk about her all day. But I'm not gonna.
I love it.
Massive detour.
Yes.
Okay, so this thing that you were talking about earlier in terms of the sort of fallibility of Norse history and how difficult it is to pinpoint the accuracy of certain things, I feel like that's this is kind of like a great playground for fantasy to slip into the fold, but like, why do you personally think Norse culture and mythology is so fitting when combined with fantasy stories?
Because the fantasy aspect is already kind of built in. The sagas have all kinds of crazy things going on that I mentioned in the previous episode if people have listened,
yeah,
to it.
Zombies.
So really just, yeah, zombies, there's ghosts, literally like in this one saga that's like famous for supernatural occurrences, it's called Eyrbyggja Saga. I believe that's the saga where they sue the ghosts to stop the hauntings.
Of course they sue the ghosts.
And I believe that's the one. Yeah, there's also a ghost seal, which is like so memeable.
I love it.
Like,
I kind of want to write a story about a ghost lawyer now.
Right?
Like a lawyer for ghosts when they get sued.
Right.
That's amazing.
Yes.
No, seriously though, like a ghost seal. I can't get that out of my head.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Also like, adorable.
What do you eat, bro? Ghost fish?
Yeah. It just like comes up through the floor and everybody freaks out and one guy like grabs a club and just beats it back down into the floor. Like that is this
all. Get back down in there.
Right. Go swim in the floor some more.
Go back where you came from, or so help me. Get down.
Monsters, Inc. reference. I love it.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I'm curious, what are your thoughts on popularity, like the popularity of Norse-inspired fantasy? Like, I'm thinking like Thor and Loki and the MCU, stuff like that.
They've definitely like mainstreamed Norse.
They have,
mythology.
But like, does it drive you crazy? Do they do it totally wrong? Do you love it? Like, what's the vibe?
I am pretty easily able to compartmentalize things like Marvel and just be like, okay, if I watch this, I know that this is not supposed to be accurately portraying Norse mythology. Like I am at peace with that. Like I have enjoyed Marvel. I went to the like however many hour marathon before the first Avengers movie where they would show all like 7 movies so far, and then they showed the Avengers. I was so in it. Love Tom Hiddleston as Loki. Fantastic actor. Like I'm a big fan. I got nothing bad to say about that. But again, that's because I mentally can divorce that from like the academic study of the myths and sagas, because Marvel's just doing its own thing. Mm-hmm. They're like, this is an alternate universe type of situation. And I'm at peace with that. What I'm not at peace with is when movies and TV say like, this is historically accurate, and then it's not.
Right.
Yeah.
Like, because then what you're doing is you're perpetuating like misinformation.
Yeah, those misunderstandings you were talking about earlier. Yeah.
Right. Right. Whereas like Marvel, it's like, we know this isn't real. And yet I was still tagged in reviews for The Witch's Heart that would say things like, you know, I really love the book. I didn't realize that Loki and Thor weren't brothers. And I was like, yep, that's a Marvel thing. That's not true in the myths. Loki and Odin are blood brothers in the myths. And Thor is Odin's son. So
I feel like they just do some of those things for, I mean, a lot of it is for the convenience of storytelling.
Yeah, simplicity.
You know? It's like, you know,
Odin
is the father figure, but they need Thor to have someone who's more comparatively opposite in terms of personality.
A foil for him.
Yes.
Yeah, a foil for him. Exactly. Yeah.
And Odin is not, that's another thing. Like Odin is not like a benevolent father figure.
No.
So like if you hear people say like, Odin protect us, it's like, will he? Right? Will he though?
Odin, like, Odin is legitimately a god of war. Like he,
like, you know, I don't.
No,
like war and death.
Yeah.
Like he has such strong associations with death. His whole thing is like getting, you know, the best warriors into Valhalla. Mm-hmm. So like, if you're any good, he wants you to die in the battlefield.
Right. So he can snatch up before
Freya does. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Well, yeah, on this note, because
Odin needs you for Ragnarok. Like,
they just got the posters.
I'm sorry you were drinking.
They just got all the posters up all over Scandinavia.
Yeah.
Odin needs you. On this note, because also like Odin is kind of portrayed as like benevolent and wise and this kind of stuff. And it's like, he can be wise, but he can also be fucking brutal. And you know, I feel like there are so many, just like you said, just sort of like stereotypes and perpetuated falsehoods about Norse mythology and culture in fiction and media. What are some other things that you've seen like authors, showrunners, directors get consistently wrong? Or like, what are some of your biggest pet peeves in that sense?
She knows. The portrayal of women is something that has been a pet peeve for me, mostly because it has bled into kind of like the living history stuff that I do and the way that patrons react to women in reenactment. I say patrons, like members of the public who come to these like Renaissance festivals and stuff, right? And before I go any further, I would just like to say, disclaimer, like huge disclaimer, what I'm about to say about women in history, I'm not talking about 2023. I think that in 2023, anybody of any gender should be able to do whatever they want. Like not whatever they want, within reason, right? Yeah. Should be able to exist authentically.
Yes.
And not have to worry about being bullied or harassed for not fitting into gender roles. Mm-hmm. Like that is giant disclaimer.
Yeah.
So one of my biggest pet peeves about how the Viking Age is perceived today is the obsession with proving that women were warriors and that this was a thing. Like, so, because there was a grave that was long thought to have been a man's grave. This is in Birka, Sweden, grave BJ581, for anybody who wants to look it up. And for the longest time, they assumed, because of the rich weaponry and all the goods that were buried with this person, that this person was a man. In 2017, the news came out that these bones, the skeleton that was in that grave was tested and was biologically female, confirmed. So immediately everybody's like, ah, women warriors, this proves it. And this is not the first time this has been like a thing. I mean, we got Lagertha from Vikings, right? But Lagertha herself is a legendary character. She is not meant to exist alongside like the women in the saga Viking age, right? Like she is from the before times.
She's mythologized at this point.
Exactly.
Also like get demigod status kind of thing.
Right. And yeah. There's like a whole, like one of the genres of the Icelandic sagas are the Fornaldarsogur, the sagas of the time before. And that's where you see shield maidens. That's where you see these, there's even like these characters who are maiden kings who go to their mothers and ask them to outfit them as a Viking like you would a son, right? And then they actually take male names and pronouns, go off raiding, and then come back and are women again. Like, so it's, there's all kinds of like cool, questionable gender stuff happening in these sources. But again, like those are the legendary sources. Those are the before times. So do I think that women warriors existed in the Viking age? I think it's totally possible. I think it's totally possible. And just the part that is my pet peeve is that we are so fixated on it. I think it's amazing. I think it's amazing that women in 2023 are finding this so empowering. But there are also other really cool things that women did in the Viking age that had nothing to do with that. And they had their own ways of having power and agency that also had nothing to do with like training as a warrior and going off to battle. Again, want to stress, shield maidens are very, very cool. But like there's other stuff that's cool too. And just to like take it back to the living history thing and why this is such like a personal like thing for me and why I'm kind of jaded about it is that at one of my first events, me and a couple of the other gals were cleaning out like a cauldron and our dishes because one of the guys had cooked this amazing stew for lunch. So we volunteered to clean up. So we're taking all our stuff over to the fire hydrant and we're cleaning. And this man walks past. He's like, huh, Viking women had to do the dishes too, huh? I thought y'all were supposed to be warriors. Where's Lagertha? I don't see Lagertha anywhere. Ugh. And we just like stared at him and then he like laughed to himself and walked away. And I'm just like, first of all, why is doing the dishes even gendered? Like You eat food off of dishes, right? Like you can clean your own dish. And second of all, this assumption that all women in the Viking age were supposed to be this like, kick-ass, like, I don't know. Like it bothers me that like, if you're not doing combat, you're kind of treated as like less important. When like you're actually like the backbone of your society.
Yeah, well, that's just I think saying. Something that a lot of readers appreciate about, or the things people appreciated about The Witch's Heart, and so did I, and it's something I have appreciated about Weaver and the Witch Queen, and I think a lot of people will, is that you have these very strong female characters who are not the trademark strong female character, right? In all caps, right? Like they aren't grabbing a, you know, the sword. Andrea, and the
I like your
well, yeah, you know what I mean, right? Where it's like the strong female character, right? Where it's like the stereotype of it. Basically I feel like I enjoy the all of the characters in the female characters in The Weaver and the Witch Queen have very feminine abilities and skills and stuff like this, and it is so empowering still. It, you know what I mean? It's that a lesser
they retain their agency.
Correct. Mm-hmm. They have this agency. They're very powerful, but not in a I need to hit something with a sword powerful, right?
Right.
So I just feel like I want you to talk a little bit more about like what your I don't know. I feel like we've already kind of touched on it, but your goals in telling these stories of these women, you know, is it to expand the idea of what a powerful woman can be, you know, those kinds of things. Can you just kind of touch on that a bit?
Yeah, because that was definitely a huge like component of it, because Gunhild herself, like in the sources, she strategizes politically. She's also known for being like cunning and conniving and manipulative. That's how she like maneuvers. That's how she holds power in this like male dominated society. And, you know, accusations of witchcraft are not far off from that. Like, oh, this is a woman in power. She must be a witch, right? There's no possible other way. And so like stuff like that. I really wanted to tell a story about women in the Viking age that didn't have to do with shield maidens, because honestly, there's a lot of a lot of ton. Please edit that out.
Oh, I'm definitely not.
There are so many awesome books that have shield maidens or shield maiden like adjacent characters in them that are just so good. Like H.M. Long's Hall of Smoke series, Norse inspired fantasy, Hesse Could Step on Me.
There's like really, that's like John Gwynne. Shadow of the Gods is a really good shield maiden character too.
There's also The Norse Queen by Joanna Wittenberg, which I don't think that's a fantasy. It does have those magical elements, but it's about Queen Elsa, who was actually Eric Bloodaxe's great grandmother. So like stuff like that, where like, exactly. So, you know, there are books that focus on shield maidens, and that's awesome. I mean, like, and then you got Lagertha, you've got Freudis in Netflix's Norsemen. Like you see these kinds of characters everywhere. And I just wanted to be like, okay, but what, there were other women doing other things at this time too, that were pretty freaking cool. Like I'm a fiber artist, I'm a fiber geek, and so like the importance of weaving and spinning is something that comes up all the time in The Weaver and the Witch Queen, because it was so like essential for people's daily lives in the Viking Age. For one thing, like women were the ones who were making sailcloths along with clothing. So the Vikings would not have gone anywhere without sails for their ships. And also as a sailcloth, like in this like gift-giving culture that they were in, this generosity, hospitality sort of focused era, a sailcloth was considered like a kingly gift,
right?
Like that was literally...
That's like you come to my house and I give you a car.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Literally, though, because it would take, if it was one woman working alone, archaeologists have estimated it would take 5 years to make one sailcloth.
Wow. Oh my God.
So like that is a hell of a time commitment. And so that's why in The Weaver and the Witch Queen, I decided to just make a workshop of women who are all just doing this. And that is a way for them to also have agency, because it's kind of like they're all together, they're earning their own money, mm-hmm. and they look out for each other.
And also textiles, you know, were a means of storytelling. It's like telling the history of a family, or telling the history of like a place or mythology and all that kind of stuff. It was like a lot of it was actually on textiles, as well as oral storytelling and all this different kind of stuff. It's like, I think like we underestimate these days how fucking vital and integral textiles are to our everyday lives. You know?
Yeah, because we could just go to the store and buy shirts.
Yeah.
Like back then you had to shear the sheep and then wash the wool and then comb the wool and then spin the wool and then warp your loom and then weave it and then cut it and sew it into garments. Yeah. Like,
oh, is that all?
That's just, is that all? Yeah. You just couldn't, you know, there was a lot more appreciation for that stuff because it was so time consuming, and that was by and large women's work. And now, even though I'm like, you know, my position is that, Viking women warriors definitely could have existed. Doesn't mean that women in the Viking Age were like passive or like, you know, you could push them around. The sagas, the Icelandic family sagas, which are the more realistic ones, definitely have their share of women who are like witty and canny and know their way around and know how to use the patriarchy, like work through the patriarchy to get what they want. So they were hardly bystanders in their own stories. There are a lot of bystanders, though. Yeah. There are a lot of women who are just mentioned and they don't kind of do anything. We don't know how they feel.
That happens in all stories too.
Yeah.
Unfortunately.
Yeah. But yes. So,
but on that note though, I want to dig a little bit deeper into your novels, The Weaver and The Witch Queen and The Witch's Heart, in terms of like, okay, you have this foundation of Norse mythology and culture sort of as like bedrock for these books. If you can speak a little bit upon why you feel like these were good fits for the stories that you wanted to tell, but also at the same time, like how these Norse inspired bedrock contributed to your approaches for things like character, plot, and world building and that kind of stuff, you know, because like you mentioned like the witticism of Norse women in the sagas, and I'm like, ha, Gunnhild.
Gunnhild.
Oh my gosh.
Gunna. Love her.
Yeah. My whole heart. She has my whole heart. I have to think about this for a second. So I've always kind of wanted to play around in this world. But especially like turning it into more of like a fantasy heavy novel, I had to consider like, okay, which parameters of this world am I keeping and which ones am I throwing out? Because like, for example, you know, I just talked a bunch about like gender roles and stuff. There are a lot of like super awesome and cozy and validating queer normative science fiction fantasy books coming out right now that I have really, really enjoyed. And I could very well have just turned Gunhild into a warrior queen and just like made like gone from there. And it would have fit into people's like pop culture opinions of like what the Viking Age was. But I wanted to go a little bit more historical. I wanted to keep those parameters, even though they're not our beliefs today, hopefully. like the very strict gender roles. But there have always been people who have transgressed gender roles as well. And women in the Viking Age were also a little bit more mobile. There were a lot of things that men couldn't do because honor. But if a woman did it, women are kind of outside the law. So like,
outlaws. You know, love it.
Yeah. Like there's Angie a part. That. Yeah. there's a part in Weaver where Eric tells Gunhild, you know, as they're fighting, which they do for the, like the first 75% of the book, like she's like, magic is for cowards and women. Like there are very strict, like he was raised to be like, this is what men do and this is what women do, and you cannot cross this line, otherwise you're unmanly, and like under the law you can literally duel somebody for calling you unmanly. Literally, this was a thing. So like just like challenging that and showing how men could also be restricted in this society. They had actually like kind of less freedom than women did in a lot of ways, like because their expectations were so tied to, you know, honor and like
reputation,
family, and reputation was huge.
Yeah,
it was a huge deal.
What's you're saying? So, you know, the ancient Norse rap battles, right? A poem could ruin your life, you know?
Yeah, like literally. And that has that, you see that in a lot of the sagas. And that's one thing that like I kind of wish I would have touched on in Weaver, but I am terrible at poetry. And that is the reason why there are no poems in the book whatsoever. Yeah.
And also people nowadays who go back and read The Lord of the Rings, are a lot of them are just like, why the fuck is there poetry in here?
And so I'm like, many
why
songs.
Why not?
Because Tolkien was the number one Norse fanboy.
Exactly.
Like,
such
I mean, I remember the first time I like just looked up one of the sagas like in their original language. Actually, I think I have one of
and
them.
He was definitely
in
the translator, wasn't he?
No, he wasn't, but he did translate some of them. But you'll see like the way that like people's titles are described will be like after the name. So you have like Haukin Jarl, Harald or Konungr, like Harold King. And that immediately makes me think of Hail Theoden King
from
Lord of the Rings.
Too.
So like that's so that Tolkien like knew that what the heck he was talking about, in case any of us were in doubt. Which we weren't. But like, but I mean, like he was deep in it. So like literally the first time I read that and I was like, that's what Tolkien
wait, like, wait, synapses are firing. I got
yes,
it.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. I just got chills when you said like Hail Theoden King. I'm just like,
oh. Yeah, right?
Yes.
Like, oh,
look, really good folks, man.
I know, right?
Oh my gosh. Well, let's get back to Weaver and the Witch Queen as much
sorry.
As I can. No, I could talk
that
about
was
Tolkien
a beautiful,
all day.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
Thank you. Yes. Thank you. Yes. I'm subtle like that. but no, I feel like we've talked a little bit about you know, the balance of the mystical elements and the historical elements and all of that. And I feel like Weaver and the Witch Queen does this, I mean, it does it really well. Honestly, to the point, so this is like an aside, but my mom doesn't really read fantasy except for she's read my books. Thanks, Mom. but I'm recommending that she read Weaver and the Witch Queen because I think that the historical elements are going to anchor it. You know what I mean? To the point that I think readers outside of the fantasy genre will really like this one as well. But yeah, can you talk a little bit more about how you went about balancing those elements and, you know, the kind of sources that you leaned on or things that you really wanted to make sure were historical versus things you wanted to play with a little bit?
So the magic system does have a basis in like in history, as we kind of excuse me, I'm losing my voice a little bit.
We've been having too much fun.
Yes. So the magical elements in The Weaver and the Witch Queen were definitely inspired by research. But what I found in my research was that there were a lot of words for sorcery and witchcraft, and they all had like different meanings, and there were kind of no rules. But for the purposes of crafting a narrative, like there had to be some kind of cap on the witch's power, otherwise they could just do whatever they want. So I had to kind of come up with ways like limitations. And I did the same thing in The Witch's Heart too, because if I made Ankh-Morpork all powerful, she could just like go up to Odin and be like,
right,
I have defeated you, right, give me my suck children it. Like, yes, exactly. There will be no Ragnarok today. Thank you very much, sir.
Just in Genevieve's day-to-day. No, thank you. No one else.
Yes, yes. So for Weaver, I had to kind of like come up with stuff. So we don't have evidence that, you know, witches would sit there with their staffs and pretend to spin, right? But is it a coincidence that witches' staffs that we've uncovered that we think are witches' staffs have a little spinny part on top, like a distaff that is used for spinning wool? Correlation. Like, also, like I mentioned, I think in the last episode, the correlation between like women's textile work and fate, the Valkyries, and weaving that tapestry, the gruesome tapestry, or
but also whatever. the way it's spoken of in terms of like the weaving of time, and yes, and the way that time kind of unfurls in, yes, Norse mythology,
yeah,
is like, and,
yeah,
this very like the like tapestry as this embodied metaphor for the fate of their universe as they perceived it.
Right. The Norns spinning the threads of fate, mm-hmm, you know, all that stuff. Yeah. So that was an obvious like connection that I wrote into the book, and in terms of like the way that Gunnhild's magic works and the way that she will go speak with the dead, which is also like a huge thing in both Norse mythology and the sagas. The dead know things. Like they know things. Even Odin goes to a dead Seeress in the Prophecy of the Seeress to ask her questions about the future.
Even the ghosts know something.
He must know something. There are also several mentions in the sagas of like, oh, we knew that animal was actually a shapeshifter. They were actually a sorcerer because of its human eyes.
Ooh.
Right? So that was also something that I wrote into the Weaver.
Yeah. That was such a cool element.
It reminded me of a sweet touch.
It reminded me of Jeff Vandermeer's Southern Reach trilogy, where there are, spoiler, people who basically are subsumed by nature within this like alien environment and are transformed into animals. And basically it's like you can see like the humanity and the sadness in their eyes of these like, aww, animals, and it's fucking creepy.
It's a Disney movie.
Like, so dark.
Yeah. Oh.
Yeah.
Sad.
Sorry to interrupt.
Yeah. But there's also the whole idea of like shapeshifting and like, you know, the connection of the animals. There is an episode from a saga called Egilsaga, which was one of my main sources for the book, because Gunnhild is Eilskotla Grimson, the title character. She is his lifelong antagonist. They just hate each other so much, and it's amazing. We don't really get Gunnhild's side of things whatsoever. It's just Eil being like, this woman insulted me, and now we are mortal enemies, like, forever. And this guy, this is so, we talked about Thorolf at the end of the last episode, Thorolf being Eil's older brother, so like Gunnhild feuds with him, and there is a memorable episode after, spoiler alert, Eric and Gunnhild are kicked out of Norway and go rule in York, England, where they make so much trouble that the King of England is just like, have your own land and leave us alone. So they ruled in York for some time, and during that episode Eilskotla Grimson is like, I think he's like shipwrecked there if I remember correctly, and he goes to Eric. And Eric's like, I'm going to kill you. You're the worst. And Arnbjorn is like, no, don't kill him. Like, have him. Arnbjorn's always the mediator, by the way.
Yeah, yeah.
We haven't talked about him yet, but
he's great.
In the sagas.
He's
thank
great,
you.
Yeah.
I just made him into a funny little guy. But like in the saga, in the sagas, he's very much like the mediator between Eric and Eil.
He feels like the lawyer of the Weaver and the Witch Queen. He's
yeah,
like, he's
so
like
he
the
is
arbitrator.
Very much the mediator in the story too. Yeah,
or he keeps the brain cells. Like, he is the keeper of the brain
parses
cells.
Parses them out as people need them.
And for me,
specifically,
so
Eric's
for me,
brain
it
cell.
Was like, I loved it because it's like, of course, he ended up with a tattoo artist, and I was like, yeah.
Oh, the fact that I had to cut so much of Arnbjorn and Rudfried, like, just makes great. Me, yeah. I just love them so much. Mm-hmm. Anyway, sorry. So in York, Arnbjorn's like, okay, so what if Eil, who is a poet, composes a praise poem of you, Eric? Yeah, composes a poem, and then he can keep his head, right? You're not going to kill him. And Eric's like, fine, whatever. And Gunnhild's like, I swear to God, if you fucking kill this guy, I swear. She's so mad. So later, Eil's like struggling to compose this poem, and there's a swallow tittering at the window, like trying to distract him. And Arnbjorn scares it away, and then sits on the roof the rest of the night and makes sure it doesn't come back. And everybody kind of just assumes that the swallow is Gunhild, and that is why her...
Oh my god, her, I love that!
Little,
her spirit
which
animal.
Form is a swallow. Yeah. So, and then it's funny because then when Aiel delivers the poem to Eric, he's just like, that was well delivered. And then there's a note, and then you go look in the back of the book, and it's like, most scholars agree that Eric had no idea what was said. And I'm like, that's my boy! That's my boy. I too do not understand poetry. So, like, that entire episode, like, just influenced so much of how I wrote all of these characters. Yeah. Like, it's just,
oh my god,
so,
I see it. So that's funny. Amazing.
Like a bit of a shit show.
I just picture just Arnbjorn just sitting on the roof, just being like,
dear, stay
fucking
away.
Swallow.
Yeah,
trying
exactly.
to fix this without bloodshed.
Good. Or, like, with a broom. It's with a broom, just like, get out of there.
Shoo, shoo. Get out of here, Goonie.
Yes, right.
Oh my god. That's brilliant. Sorry, I just need to like compose myself.
You know?
You've spoken of the so many different resources. You've spoken of the poetic edda, the prose edda, and all these different things. What advice would you give to authors when it comes to researching Norse history, culture, mythology, sort of like a good starting point for people who want to, you know, get in and start digging and then have points where they can branch off and kind of find their own path?
Okay, so that is a great question. The number one piece of advice that I would give anybody who wants to write about this time period or this culture is to be careful of where your source is coming from. A meme that you saw on Facebook is not a source. That person on TikTok who has no qualifications is not a source. And anybody who tries to give you like solid answers, be like, this is the way it was, be suspicious, because even scholars in history books admit that there's so much we don't know. And so much that we'll never know until we get a TARDIS and go back in time and, you know, speak Old Norse to people in the Viking Age. I would say start by reading the prose edda and the poetic edda. I recommend for the poetic edda, Carolyn Larrington's translation, and for the prose edda, Anthony Falks's translation. Those are the two that we used in my Nordic mythology class, which is the one where I wrote The Witch's Heart in, instead of writing my term paper, which I still got an A on, by the way.
Also, for the record, even if you didn't get an A on it, I think that worked out well for you in the end.
it was also about Angerboda. So like, of course it was. My professor handed it back to me. She was like, well done. Clearly you were very invested. I'm like, I haven't slept for 3 weeks because I've just been writing about her. I just been writing this
like
book.
You have no idea how invested.
I know. Like possibly unhealthily invested. Yeah. So in addition to those two sources, I would also say Children of Ash and Elm by Neil Price. It's also a very good audiobook that I greatly enjoyed, even though I don't really do audiobooks that much. It's like having a documentary narrated at you.
I love that.
Their narrator is so good. And he also is one of the narrators for H.M. Long's Darkwater Daughter, which is out in the U.S. on the 18th, I believe, mm-hmm. Which is Flintlock Pirate Fantasy. So sorry, I just had to like cram in my Hannah
I love it.
Reference.
Yeah.
Hannah plug. So yeah, Children of Ash and Elm by Neil Price. Valkyrie, The Women of the Viking World by Johanna Katrin Friedrichsdottir is also really, really good. It talks a lot about like the literary sources. I actually have like my pile of books right here. This is it. Hi, Valkyrie. Just a quick plug for Valkyrie. And it's, I found it really accessible. Same thing with Children of Ash and Elm. They're really good places to start, but again, you have to keep in mind that this is just like one person's opinion and one person's reading of these sources. A different scholar could read the same sources and come up with totally different conclusions. Also maybe get an academia.edu subscription if you can, because I don't, there's a lot of really cool articles and they come out more quickly than books do a lot of the time, even though they're peer reviewed. You know, publishing, as we know, takes a while. So sometimes like a book will come out and the information in the book will have already been, I don't know, discussed or disproven elsewhere. Maybe not disproven, but like another scholar might have offered their
questioned
or provided their interpretation. Exactly. So yes, nothing about the Viking Age is straightforward. And you just kind of have to take a more interdisciplinary approach to it and be like, okay, here's what the literary sources say, but what does archaeology say? What do contemporary sources from other places say? And how did the people writing it affect what they're actually saying about the Vikings? So
I think it's hilarious and a little bit sad that fantasy publishing takes longer than academic publishing.
Well,
I think that might be true. Yeah,
probably is.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Well, I feel like, so we've talked a little bit about this. So I want to dig into it a little more before we close out. You are involved in the historical reenactment community for Norse culture. How did you get started with that? What's your favorite part about it? How does it inspire your books and your work? Like just all, like, just let's just dig into that a little bit.
So I started when, after I had to decline acceptance to the graduate program of my dreams at the University of Iceland, I got real sad and I bought a Viking outfit off of the internet and I wore it to the medieval fair, the local medieval fair. And I had people come up to me multiple times, be like, are you with that group? I'm like, what group? Well, the group eventually found me, and 9 years later, I'm still with them.
Oh my God, I love that.
So that's kind of how I got started. And like we as a group, as well as like the scene, the whole scene of Viking Age living history, at least in the US, it's just blown up. Like we personally are trying to be like, we've been getting more authentic. Like if you look at the pictures from 5, 6, 7 years ago, they're very different from the pictures of us that you might see today. And I came into this hobby knowing a lot of stuff about the myths and sagas, but I didn't know a lot about the material culture. I didn't know a lot about archaeology. So there was a learning curve for me because I didn't know anything about any of that stuff. I just knew the stories and I just knew what was in the books. So it really helped give me like a more hands-on immersive experience. Like I've spun wool by hand. I've done tablet weaving, which is mentioned multiple times in The Weaver and the Witch Queen. That is like my craft of choice. I actually did a demonstration for it for another group on Monday. So so that's kind of like my thing. And so basically just, again, like taking a more interdisciplinary approach and just being able to do these things with my own two hands makes it easier to write about them. So like, I honestly, like I'm thinking about like learning combat just so I can write about combat better, like write better fight scenes. So there's a lot of opportunity there and the community is so big, growing all the time. And it's very supportive, I have found. There's always people willing to share their knowledge, always people willing to teach. You do get some assholes who are just like, there's too many stitches in your tunic, right? Like that the construction of your tunic is wrong. I'm like, I'm sorry. I don't think that in the Viking Age, they would have been like, that wool that we just spent like a million hours weaving, that tunic is wrong. So we're gonna throw it out or like redo right. it because it's wrong. Like there wasn't like a uniform, right? Yeah. Right?
Like, it doesn't have to be like H&M like consistency, right. Right. Big manufactured corporation consistency.
Right. And that's also a whole thing because like the biggest textile fragment we have is like this big. So it's like, how can you tell me that there was only one way a dress was constructed?
Right.
Like they didn't have Google. They couldn't be like, how did Astrid from the next fjord over make her dress? Right. Like, you know, like,
give me a manual, Astrid.
Right. Astrid, where did you get that pattern? Like, that's not what they did. But also, you know, then you have other people who are like trying to stretch things too far and the community goes,
reel it back in. Reel it back.
Like one thing, at least in the US, that is like very accepted and is becoming a little bit less so, I think, is like you see a lot of people, especially in the summer, wearing brightly dyed linen, and linen would not have held color that well back then.
But also dyes were super expensive.
Yeah. And so if you're wearing like a brightly colored kit, you're rich. If you're not, you are not rich. But like we kind of accept that these brightly dyed linens, we can wear them to the festivals and stuff because it's so freaking hot, you know? And it's also really hard to find really thin wool too, because wool does wick sweat. Like it's okay to wear in hot weather if it's thin enough, but like you can't find thin wool over here. But like if you look at pictures from European reenactments, everybody's wearing either bleached or undyed linen or brightly dyed wool. So like that, I learned about dye stuffs to be able to write about them. So there's a lot of mentions in Weaver about like, this is what this was dyed with and this was what that was dyed with. That's also something the Northmen goes pretty hard on too. Sorry to keep bringing that film up,
no,
but they
really
did an amazing job.
I recommend
they did an amazing job with the costuming. I heard people like within the living history community be like, like you see like Alexander Skarsgård's character and Anya Taylor-Joy's character in the one scene, and they're both wearing like kind of like, you know, they look like they got a grim dark filter on, right? Everything's kind of bland and stuff. And so people are like, this is just going to be another one of those movies. But then you see the rich people and they're all wearing like these brightly dyed beautiful garments. And it's like, yeah, Alexander and Anya's characters look like this because they are enslaved. They are wearing undyed, rough looking clothing. Like, so just, and also I know some of the crafters who made things for the film, which is amazing that they were like, let's talk to some living history people and get like the correct tablet weaving, right? So there's also a scene in which Nicole Kidman is weaving on a near the beginning, she's weaving, doing tablet weaving, but she doesn't have a weft thread. So she's not really going to get anywhere because she's not passing a thread through it. So she's just turning the cards. But then again, like, it's a very complicated pattern. And if I were the person who made that pattern, I'd be like, you don't get a weft thread.
Right. Don't even touch it.
You don't ruin this. So, yeah. Yeah. They went hard in that film. That film could, like, is straight out of the sagas. Like,
love it.
Robert Eggers was actually on my favorite podcast. One of my favorite podcasts, Saga Thing, to talk about like his inspirations from the sagas. And that was really cool to listen to because he actually also listens to the podcast. Nice. So yeah, small world.
Yeah. But overall, it's like the way that you kind of approach it left me feeling very immersed in your books.
You.
It's like reading The Witch's Heart and reading The Weaver and The Witch Queen. I'm like, this, MJ, you mentioned your mom would probably be like the perfect audience for this. I feel like those are the small details that really sell you on it. Cause it's like, everything feels naturally and it fits within the context of society and within the actions of the characters and everything like that. It's like the way you incorporate clothing, the way you incorporate weaponry, the way you incorporate even like tattoos and stuff. Like as a tattoo artist, I was like, good on you, girl. Like, got this shit.
That's also like a big debate in the living history community is like, were Vikings tattooed?
Most people were tattooed back then. Like a lot of people were tattooed. All you need is like something sharp and some sort of dye or ink and you can tattoo.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. It's not we've got evidence in Europe going back thousands of years. So
it's not
going
to be pretty.
Yeah.
But
right.
I might get an
poke.
Infection. Yeah. A little scarred, infected stick and poke is going to be beautiful.
Right.
Reminds me of college. No.
Oh gosh. Yeah, I like it. So, but I just appreciate that you have said that because I really tried to make these books accessible, you know, and part of that is like the way that I tried to write them kind of very straightforward because I feel like people would get overwhelmed with the names and the terms. So if I like added all of that stuff and like made all my prose purple, I feel like it would just be like overwhelming. So it's like, I'm just here to tell you a good story. Just like sit down and be in the world with me for a second. And I'll take you on this little journey, through the frozen north. And, I hope you have fun because I really want more people to be interested in this stuff. And I'm sure that not everybody sees this time period and this culture the way that I do, but I hope that those people then go do their own research because like, I don't know everything. I am not an expert and my interpretations, not everybody's supposed to agree with them. Like I'm not, especially in like, you know, The Witch's Heart, I didn't set out to rewrite Ongar Boda's story. The fact is she doesn't have a story. And if you gave 1,000 authors the task of writing Ongar Boda's story, you're going to get 1,000 different stories. And I think the same could be said with Gunnhild in some ways, even though she does more, we know more about her. There are different interpretations of her and mine is just one. So
yeah,
well,
that's
that.
A really, disclaimer.
No, that's a really good point to end on because I think it's
yeah, say beautifully said.
Yeah, fantasy is a good vehicle to get people interested in things beyond, and I think it's always good to broaden your horizons and just it's like if something piques your interest, just go do a fucking rabbit hole. We live in the best time to dive into things and research
really
and all that. So
and like me coming into all this stuff through academia is just one way, right? Because I know people who have gotten into living history through their favorite metal bands, like talking about like Viking stuff, or through Skyrim, like they really like or Assassin's Creed Valhalla, or God of War Ragnarok. You know, like there's so many ways to get into this, and not one of them is wrong. You know, I'm not going to sit here and be like, "Well, I'm a stuffy academic, and you video game nerds are
doing it wrong."
I don't know, doing it wrong. My way is the only way. No, there is room for all of us at the table, and frankly, a rising tide raises all ships, as they say.
I love that.
Yeah.
A rising tide weaves all sails.
Yes. Yes. Frankly, the more people that are interested in this stuff, the more we're going to have books like this. Yeah. I wish there were more. I wish I had more Norse fantasy, especially Norse fantasy written by Nordic folks, you know, like in translation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because, you know, Americans and Brits, we write a lot of the English language versions of this stuff. So I would love to see more Nordic fantasy in translation.
Yeah, I agree. All right. Well, we'll leave it at that. But that was fantastic, Genevieve. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you.
That's it for this mini masterclass and our two-parter with Genevieve. And yeah, thank you again for taking the time to hang out with us and do the book launch and do this masterclass on something that you're very passionate about, but also very knowledgeable about. And I love
thank you so much for having
me. I love it when people can just nerd out to their heart's content.
Yes.
It's most beautiful thing, watching someone just light up like a Christmas tree, right? Yeah. And this has been super fun.
Thank you.
Yeah. As well, for anyone who contributes to our Patreon at $10 or more a month, there will be a reading by Genevieve from The Weaver and the Witch Queen. I recommend you go pick it up. It's already out by the time this episode will release. Go pick up Thick as Thieves as well. Genevieve, where can people find you on social media? Ooh, you're such a good plugger for your friends.
I know, I was going to say.
Look at all these books.
Pick up the sequel to Among Thieves by MJ Goon. It's called Thick Ass Thieves.
Yeah, Thick Ass Thieves.
I'm most active on Instagram at Jen Gornacek. That's Jen with a G. I have a Facebook and a Twitter page that I rarely use. I have a TikTok account that I deleted all the videos on, all like 6 videos, because I couldn't have people perceiving me. I'm very shy in real life. And like the fact that like people are seeing my face, kind of freaks me out a little bit. And I know that I'm saying that like I'm on YouTube
as people are watching
by the time anybody is watching this. Yes. Yeah, this is mildly terrifying. It's fine. So don't look for me on TikTok, because you will find me and nothing, no content. Instagram's the way to go if you want to get in touch. So
cool. You can also follow SFF Addicts on Instagram, Twitter, and Threads at SFF Addicts Pod. Or you can follow me at Adrian M. Gibson. MJ, where can people find you?
Yeah, you can find me everywhere, TikTok, Twitter, Instagram, Threads, all the things, at MJ Coon Books.
And in your dreams.
I guess.
That's so sinister.
That is very sinister.
Yeah. MJ the Dream Weaver.
There we go.
Beautiful. You've been upgraded from dragon. You're a dream weaver.
I like it. See, I'm just moving up in the world here.
Stepping it up. Yeah. Troglodyte, dragon, dream weaver. You got this.
Love this for you.
Thank you. Yeah, me
so
too.
So happy for you. All right. Thank you, everyone. Now, keep reading, keep imagining, and we'll see you next time on SFF Addicts.